The House will please come to order to sit again as Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is...
Chairman, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you. You've got a revised list that came out this afternoon, a couple revisions to the revision. Please move House Bill 133 till after House Bill 81. That's so the students who are here can see that bill debated after they've talked with us. And please move House Bill 35 to below House Bill 124.
Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 73. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 73, introduced by Representative Pedersen, an act relating to dental services freedom bill relating to insurance. This bill was referred to Committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Kraft, Gay, Gingrey, Green, Harvey, Hunt, Miller, Peasley, absent, Barbuto, signed, Representative Harvey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Harvey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 73 do pass, and I would turn the explanation of the bill over to the good sponsor.
Representative Pedersen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll go through the explanation of the bill, and then I'm going to move the two amendments to kind of work through our process that way. This particular bill comes to us through something that has been identified of a practice that has become somewhat prolific on the East Coast. And where I want to explain this is that when a contract is made between a dentist and the insurance company, they go over to reimburse the dentist for what is called covered services. These are things like having your teeth cleaned, some of your do you want to move that? But beg your pardon.
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Harvey, did you want to move the standing committee amendment?
Yes, sir. I would like to move the standing committee amendment and would also leave that explanation over to the fine sponsor of the bill.
Thank you, Chairman Harvey. Representative Pedersen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Madam Chairman, for bringing the standing committee amendment one. I will since we're on that subject, I'll bring the standing committee amendment number one. I am not a bill drafter by nature. There are 11 states that have done this, 33 have it on the docket. In my selection process for which one I would do, my wife is Lakota Sioux. The Lakota word for friend is Dakota, and in the late 1880s, two of our friends to the east joined our union. I took the one from the north as its language. That was for the good representative from House District 3 on how we can reference without referencing. I chose the language, and in that language, they don't reference the same way that we do in the bill. This cleanup language that I would urge you all to look at is brought to us through there's a department that looks over the insurance. They have a commissioner and worked with him over, because he's the one who has to oversee all of this. And this language better conforms to how we do the bill. This was really an oversight on my part by not involving him in the beginning. And this is cleanup language. And if you read, the other language almost leads you to believe that the insurance policy is between the dentist and the insurer, when in fact a policy is between an insurer and an individual. And so this is the cleanup language that we worked with the department. We also worked with local insurance companies and worked with dentists to draft. And so at this point, I'd like to call for the question on standing committee amendment number one to House Bill 73.
You've heard the motion on the standing committee amendment. Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The standing committee amendment number one has been adopted. We are back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, at this time I'd like to move the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 73. I will explain the bill and explain how this comes into the bill in my process and ask the question later. As I had said to you before, the way that insurance companies and dentists and individuals work together is a process. And what will happen is an insurance company will put together its list of covered services. And as I mentioned, this is fillings. This is cleaning your teeth. This is all those things that we all get done every 6 months and go in and have them taken care of. And then you have a whole litany of things that are non-covered services, things that you do cosmetically. My wonderfully bright smile is due to fake veneers in the front due to my chipped up teeth from a series of bad choices when I was younger. But that's all cosmetic. I could walk around with chipped up teeth just the same and function, but this was my choice. So I paid out of my pocket for this. This is a non-covered service. I can't reimburse it to my insurance company in any way, shape, or form. So what happened, and you're going to have to walk me through this, I'm going to have to give you an example of how this works. This bill does not change what's covered and what isn't covered. And it doesn't change the things that are covered, their prices or anything along those lines. All it's saying is that non-covered services, an insurance company cannot create a fee schedule for that. And how does this happen and where does it come from? Let's start a business here, and we're going to call it the Committee of the Whole Vineyard, because I think cow, C-O-W, wine would be a fun thing to see. So in our Committee of the Whole Vineyard, we are out there and we're going to have our business meeting, and we're going to have the insurance companies come and pitch us and let us know, and we're going to decide who to get. And where this came from was as a company would come forward and they'd say, hey, you folks, if you come underneath us, this is our list of the fees that we will have the dentist honor for what is reimbursable. But what we're also going to do is we're going to say that they have to honor these fees that are non-reimbursable on the schedule, i.e. they'd have to say that the dentist has to perform these veneers at $500 a tooth. And what they would do then is it turns into a strong arm practice against the dentist and really comes between the dentist and the patient. Because what the insurance company will say is if you want access to these 60 people here in our company, Committee of the Whole, then you have to honor our fee schedule. And that includes the stuff that we're not going to reimburse you for, Mr. Dentist. And so, and this practice became somewhat prolific on the East Coast. It hasn't come here, but what happened was it got a lot of people excited about it. And now, there, as I said to you, 11 states have passed and 33 have drafted and introduced much the same way that we do and are working it through their process in order to prevent this from happening. Because it also comes between, it doesn't allow the individual to shop dentists for these non-covered services. If a dentist wants to charge $200 a tooth for something like this and make it up on volume, that's their choice. If they want to charge $1,100 a tooth and say that they're the best, that's their choice. They can make that decision, and an individual can choose to go to anybody for any price they have. And this is actually a bill that defends really free market and free market capitalism by preventing insurance companies for providing for a schedule for fees for non-covered services. And that's what brings me really to now the end of the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1. Once again, I would remind you that I am not the best drafter of the bills, and I am learning, and I will better involve LSO from the very beginning next time. And in my second go-round, if you'll notice in there, I'm changing a may to a shall. And if you leave it as may, it guts the bill, because then there's no enforcement. If you change it to shall, then you're saying that they shall not engage in this type of thing. And may leaves it open so you may not even don't even pass the bill if you leave may in. So I call for question on Committee of the Whole Amendment 1.
We are on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 73. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Haven't got that. Mm-hmm. Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Harvey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill number 73 do pass, please say aye. Opposed? House Bill 73 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 75. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 75, introduced by Representative Escobel, an act relating to criminal procedure regarding victim notification amendments. This bill was referred to Committee No. 1 Judiciary, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Barbuto, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Peasley, Throne. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 75 do pass. There are no amendments, and I would turn the explanation of the bill over to the sponsor.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before lunch, I had a handout delivered to your desk. It comes from the United States Department of Justice, Office of Violence Against Women. When you look at the top, it talks about the arrest program funding, and they would not be entitled to 5% of their total funds under the arrest program grant unless states and local governments, one, certified it had this law and regulation in place. The testing of it to be not more than 48 hours after the date of which the information or the indictment was presented. And then second, to give the Attorney General assurance that this law and regulation will be in compliance with the requirements of paragraph 1 by the period ending on the dates of which the next session of the state legislature ends. Also in bold type on that, it talks about submission of state, tribal, and local statutes, laws, and policies in lieu of a letter with proper certification signed by the chief executive officer will not satisfy these statutory requirements. And that brings us to the reason why we have the bill today. Section A is the first part where you see the new language, and that is at the consent of the person accused. So he may go ahead and tell the law enforcement officer that he we'll go ahead and take that test, and in B, if that accused person is unwilling or unable to give consent, the court may warrant upon sufficient showing of probable cause by affidavit to have that test administered within the 48 hours for those sexually transmitted diseases, and then in C, at the request of the victim, but not later than 48 hours, and I'll stand for question. If there's no questions, I'll call for the question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Brown's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 75 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 75 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 29. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 29, introduced by Representative Gingrey, an act relating to driving under the influence, DUI elimination of the right to refuse test. This bill was referred to Committee No. 1 Judiciary, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Barbuto, Brown, Kennedy, Crone, Throne. No, Brechtel, Green, Nicholas, Peasley. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 29 do pass, and I further move Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 29. And, Mr. Chairman, Standing Committee Amendment 1 is merely a technical correction to the bill, and I would, unless there's some concern, I would call for the question on that and then ask that it go to the sponsor for explanation.
Question having been called for, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I have to start by saying that we have, in the past few years, done some really good things in the area of DUI law. Last year, we did the two-hour rule. We've done ignition interlock. We've done look-backs. So there are certainly things that we should be proud of in that what we have done to bring down DUI rates. However, one of the biggest problems that we have in this state is our refusal rate. And because of the high refusal rate, many people that are drunk driving walk away without a punishment. Our refusal rates in some counties go as high as 75%. In my own county, if you look at a first-time DUI that's pulled over, about 25% of the time they're going to refuse. That's actually pretty normal. That matches actually the national average. When you get to second and subsequent refusal, you get up into the area of 75%. Over in Albany County, they're looking at a second and subsequent at 64%. Statewide, it sits at about 42. Those are high rates of refusal on second and subsequent. What does that tell us? It tells us that on a first-time DUI, most people are complying. However, once they've been through the system once, then they recognize that potentially they should not comply and they will walk away without punishment, or at least just administrative punishment, not with a criminal punishment. So you come at this issue from two different directions. If you're trying to deal with the issue of refusal, you can either, what some states have done is make refusal a crime. So if you refuse, then that's a criminal act, and you make the punishment the same as if they had violated the DUI statute. And we've looked at that. We looked at that last year. I think we looked at it the year before. And then there's the other way of looking at it, which is what this bill does, and this is a copy of what South Dakota does, and that is to eliminate the right of refusal completely. Now, how does that work? Well, you consented. That's what we call implied consent. Driving is not a right. Driving is a privilege. We give you a driver's license. Under that driver's license, you have consented to a search of effervescent evidence. Effervescent evidence is evidence that will disappear, such as blood, urine, or breath. So here's how it normally works out on the street. So an officer observes a articulable, reasonable suspicion for pulling you over. Perhaps you have violated a traffic law, and so he pulls you over. At that point, he will talk with you. Maybe he observes bloodshot eyes, the smell of alcohol, you're fumbling for the wallet, you have slurred speech, something of that sort. And so then he will ask you to exit the vehicle. He then does what's called FSTs, field sobriety tests. This is what you see, horizontal gaze nystagmus tests, you know, walking a line, those types of things. At that point, he then can place you under arrest for DUI and then transport you to the local jail. It's at the local jail is where you actually blow in the intoximeter. The intoximeter is where you actually get the number, what we call the BAC, your blood alcohol content. If you're over .08, you're guilty of DUI. Almost every time, it's always going to be breath, mostly because that's just the easiest. And there used to be an argument that, you know, some people just had health issues, they couldn't breathe in hard enough, those types of things. The machines that they have now and the technology now, you barely breathe into the thing and it registers your alcohol content. That's not normally been an issue much anymore. When would you ever do urine or blood? Well, it usually actually comes up very rarely, but if there is an incident where the officer actually does not smell alcohol and does not suspect alcohol, but you're clearly impaired, at that point the officer is going to suspect drugs. The only way to determine drugs, certainly not through a breath test, is through blood or urine. And a lot of times when the blood test is actually being done, it's actually being requested by the defendant. How this works is the officer gets first choice on which test to give you. So the officer will say blood, breath, or urine. For the most time, the officer is going to ask you for your breath. Occasionally they'll ask for the blood if it's alcohol or if it's a drug, and they'll ask urine if it's THC, a cannabinoid of some sort. The defendant is then permitted to request a test be done, a second test, to verify it. So a lot of times a defendant is actually the one that asks for the blood test because they want to verify the result of the breath test. Now, presently under the law, when the officer, under the implied consent law, talks to the individual, they are allowed to refuse. If you refuse, your only punishment is that you get an administrative penalty. You lose your license for 6 months, or if it's a second or subsequent, you lose for 18 months. However, that doesn't actually always translate exactly that same way, because you're entitled to go to a hearing, and in some situations you can be given limited driving privileges. And plus, while you're waiting for your hearing, you are permitted to drive. So, yes, you are penalized administratively, but there is no criminal penalty for a refusal. So then I handed out to you two different documents, both by the same author. He is the official traffic safety prosecutor for the state of Wyoming. And he wrote an article on implied consent, and also he wrote an article on the constitutionality of forced blood draws on DUI suspects. In order to explain that best, I'm going to read from an email from the district attorney in Casper. He actually explains it much better than I do. And what he says is, of course we seize evidence as is provided by the Constitution, and the case is giving us guidance to enforce the Constitution. In fact, forensic evidence in all crimes may be collected if the limitations of the Constitution are honored, except one, DUI. Why do we let DUI offenders and no one else prevent us from obtaining definitive forensic evidence of guilt or innocence when no other defendant is given that right? The only reason is that Wyoming has passed a statute saying so. There are no special constitutional protections for drunk drivers under either the U.S. Constitution or the Wyoming Constitution. Since Merber versus California, almost 50 years ago, the United States Supreme Court held that the Fifth Amendment did not prevent police officers from forcibly taking blood samples from drivers who did not consent. The court has never varied from that position. Wyoming has followed this holding in cases like Van Order, Allen v. State, Brunmeiser, and Mengel. However, that court has also held in several cases that the Wyoming legislature has limited the ability to collect such samples. It is solely because of this legislation that drunk drivers receive favored treatment under Wyoming law. What the legislature imposes, they can amend. It is solely up to the legislature to determine if they will maintain this pro-drunk driver law. And that's the end of his quote. And that's from the DA. Essentially what he is saying, and what the statutes will show you, and what the case law, is there's this case called Schmerber. And Schmerber was a case where a blood draw was taken in 1966, and the court came back and said that does not violate your Fifth Amendment right. Your Fifth Amendment right is your right against self-incrimination through testimony. That's oral. It's not forensic evidence. For example, there's a case called Cup versus Murphy. Guy kills his wife. When he's strangling her, he gets the skin of her skin underneath his fingernails. The officer recognizes that. Now, if under the U.S. Supreme Court, they say that's effervescent evidence. That's evidence that will disappear. You do not have time to go get a search warrant. At that point, they can take the skin from underneath the fingernails in order to obtain the evidence that that actually was the skin of his wife that is underneath his fingernails. So the case law is clear. The states that, in one particular state to the east of us that has adopted this, have actually not had issues with doing it this way, and they have seen a decrease in the number of refusals. And once you have a decrease in the number of refusals, those are convictions, and those are people you're keeping off the street. I actually disagree with increasing penalties. I think we actually are doing this right. First-time DUI, we treat very well. Those are people that just simply make a mistake. In many situations, those are our friends and neighbors who had one too many drinks, and that we treat it appropriately. It's a fine, and you'll never, ever see that person again. They learn from their mistake. They move on. What concerns me is what's called recidivists, those who are repeat offenders over and over. Those are the people we're trying to get at. And those are the people that have figured out that through this refusal law that they can walk away from being convicted. If this was a vehicular homicide, we take the blood. We automatically do it. It's actually in the Wyoming statute that we automatically do it. What is the distinction between where you actually completed the act and actually killed somebody and perhaps you almost killed somebody? Because you killed someone, now we do get to take your blood, and because we almost killed somebody, that person, we don't get to take your blood. This is a common practice done with multiple different offenses ongoing within our jurisdiction, within our judicial system, and I would urge you to seriously consider endorsing this bill and voting aye to get rid of the concept of refusal, and that we could hopefully reduce the rate of DUI in the state of Wyoming.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question has to do with why the good bringer of the bill has decided to go this direction instead of the bills that he's brought previously that simply make refusal a sign of guilt.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excellent question. I, in the past 2 years, have brought bills that would make a refusal a crime. Many people weren't very comfortable with that concept. About 15 states have done that. There were more people that were more interested in this concept of what South Dakota has done as to just getting rid of refusal altogether. Since we already do it for multiple different crimes in this state, why don't we just go ahead and do it for DUI? To be honest with you, either direction I'm comfortable with. I just think we need to pick one of those directions and go with it. We got to find some way to bring down these refusal rates down to a more acceptable number.
Chairman Harvey? No. Is there any other discussion on the bill? No. Representative Crone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to highlight a few things that the representative from Teton County has hit on that I think are important. I rise in support of this bill. As a prosecutor, I see that what we have is a core of almost professional defendants. So you have folks that come in on a third or a fourth or a fifth or a sixth DUI that know the system so well and know that they have the right to refuse a chemical test and do that each and every time. So what we have in law enforcement is a situation where you have these hardcore offenders, in my view, that are gaming the system. And as was mentioned by my friend from Jackson, we don't do this in any other case. If someone were to break into your house and a suspect was gained and refused to give fingerprints, we would ask we would demand through the court process that person give fingerprints. If someone was raped and a defendant didn't want to give a DNA sample, we would demand through the courts that happened. So this is a situation where we're looking at people that know the system very well, defendants that know the system very well, who are dangerous, who are the most dangerous drivers out on the highway, multiple offense DUI offenders. So I believe that this puts us in line with other ways we handle criminal cases. It puts us in line with the way we currently handle voting under the influence. So I'd urge my colleagues of the 61st to vote aye on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one quick question for the good sponsor, and I just want to make sure that I understand the bill. We basically, there would be no, you would not be able to refuse the test. So if this piece of legislation is passed, then it wouldn't be a matter of trying to bring down the refusal rate. There just would be no refusal rate, because once you were in the custody of law enforcement, you would go back to the joint law enforcement center or whatever, and so the refusal rate part of the DUI law would just simply be gone. There'd be no refusal rate in Wyoming. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's an excellent point. Yeah, I misstated that. Your refusal rate wouldn't come down. It actually would disappear.
Representative Peasley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you need to hear just a little bit from the other side, not necessarily the dark side. Each year we have another bill. We have a steady stomping parade along the line of tougher and tougher laws, and we don't seem to be making any progress. And I just want you to remember that this is that first-time offender that we're told is so well treated by the system, and he's going home and he thinks it's a pretense stop. He doesn't think the officer should have pulled him over, and he's just stubborn and don't take it. Well, he gets carted off. He gets taken down, strapped down, and blood drawn. I mean, something right out of a good old-fashioned vampire movie, I suppose. And I'm not going to say it'll happen that way. I'm just telling you that this is a pretty intrusive concept. Now, we would have never thought of this 10 years ago, but we're now here, and we're used to this. And we're used to treating the innocent right and the guilty wrong strongly. And it seems funny that this comes up at a time when criminals are given so many rights, we can't even use coercive interrogation for people who we know have important, effervescent information that is going to go away. And we drag in the entire cabal of lawyers and protect them. And this person goes down without counsel, without squawk, perhaps somewhat muzzled, and his blood is taken. I want to also just say this on the floor today, because I'm sure you're going to pass this. You have to pass this. This is good. It makes you feel good. And we get another step, another tool, and we move on. But it's going to keep going. And I've already heard talk about now the barricades we're going to have to erect around town to pull everybody over on New Year's Eve to just run them through, because those are not prohibited by the Constitution. I'm just going to be curious to watch as I grow old how far we go down this road and where we end up in our very safe and secure, brave new world. Thank you.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to kind of continue on, or I guess to expand a little bit on this immediately preceding speaker, is it say anywhere in this Bill 29 what happens if you refuse anyway? You know, it says that you can't refuse, but, you know, when you get people coming in there in the kind of condition they're in, and if they refuse, what kind of a scenario, what kind of a sequence of events occurs if you do refuse? I mean, do they really strap you down, or do they force you to breathe in? I mean, I'm having trouble. How do they force you to do something you refuse to do when you're talking about these kind of sampling? I mean, those three tests, the only one I can really see that they could force you to do is the blood test, right? I mean, and if that were the case, then what really happens? I mean, what goes on in the cop shop when that refusal occurs?
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the questions. I'll try to take one of these at a time. There was the question about having a bill every year. About 2 years ago, I agreed with that concept, and I was tired of seeing one little bill each year, little baby steps we were taking. So about 2 years ago, I brought one large comprehensive bill, and it didn't make it. So I brought it again last year, and the comments back was, this is too much. We need to take baby steps. So I backed up and brought it as baby steps. So I've tried both directions, bringing them as small steps and bringing it as a comprehensive bill, bringing everything at once. I think either strategy is always going to have issues with it. The question, there was a statement about effervescent evidence. Effervescent evidence is evidence that will disappear. It will dissipate quickly. That's the distinction there. As to how do they deal with the situation now? Well, we actually have experience with this, in particularly when you're dealing with serious bodily injury. In DUI cases right now where there's probable cause, where there's serious bodily injury or there's been death, we actually allow for
the blood test to be taken involuntarily. Actually, the law reads, draws on an unconscious person or an individual otherwise in a condition rendering him incapable of refusal to submit. For the most part, how that's handled is in a hospital, and actually through the rules and regulations of the collection of evidence promulgated by the drug testing lab, it has to actually be done by medical personnel, and that's always done. They're transported to a hospital, and the blood is taken. I've never heard of anyone actually being strapped down. They just, you know, take the blood. When we contacted South Dakota to see what's been their experience, they have had it now for 3 years, and they have actually not had that experience. They thought they were going to, but they have not. So this scenario that sounds sort of scary has not occurred in the state east to us, and for those cases in which we've had to deal with it, luckily we don't have that many death and serious bodily injury, it has not been an issue up to this point.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. After the law enforcement officer involuntarily takes part of my body and sends it off for analysis, what happens to the medical information and the DNA and the spare blood that they have after it's taken? Is that kept in some sort of criminal database so that you can compare my DNA with other people, or is it destroyed, or the access to all of the medicine that I'm taking, antibiotics or whatever? When healthcare providers do that, there's all kinds of statutory protections. I'm wondering what happens when law enforcement takes my blood for non-medical purposes. What happens to the medical information that's contained in there, and how does this bill address that?
Chairman Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have another question for the good sponsor of the bill. Delineate for me at what point in time under the present law is the officer required to advise them of their rights, and would that change if we adopted this law? What point in the process then would the defendant be advised of their rights? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the advisement of rights, that would occur at the side of the car immediately after the officer has removed the person from the vehicle and performed the FSTs, the field sobriety test, and has determined that he has probable cause to make the arrest. At that point, he would advise them of their rights. The one right that I think maybe that you're getting at is the right to remain silent. And again, that's where the Schmerber case comes in, that says your right to remain silent actually, and what they're denoting there is your Fifth Amendment right, your right against self-incrimination, only is applicable to oral testimony, not to physical evidence. As to the other question about my DNA information, those are within the rules of the drug court lab, the drug lab, and I'm not sure what they do with it. I do know what the reports look like when they come back, and the report that comes back will tell the blood alcohol content and if there was not alcohol. And again, it's really important to point out the blood test is done almost exclusively only when alcohol is clearly not the reason for the impairment, that it appears it's a drug of some sort. So it'll come back listing the levels of the different drugs in the person's system and highlighting which drug is actually the one that's causing the impairment, if at all there was a drug. But as to what they do with the samples afterwards, I am not sure as to what they do with those.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Brown's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 29 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
House Bill number 29 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Was there a request for division? Serious quest for division? All those who are in favor of House Bill 29, please stand. All those opposed to House Bill 29, please stand. House Bill 29 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 81. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 81, introduced by Representative Dave Zwanitzer, an act relating to property regarding vacant land. This bill was referred to Committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Stubson, Noe, Illaway, Yagi, Shepperson, Sign, Representing Illaway, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with recommendation that House Bill 81 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee amendments. And I'd call for the vote on the Standing Committee amendment, and then the good representative from House District 9 can report on the bill.
You've heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment number 1. Are you ready for the question?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like the Standing Committee Amendment explained.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman McComey. Please, are you going to explain the Standing Committee Amendment to Representative Dave Zwanitzer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to do that. The Standing Committee Amendment on House Bill 81, on the bottom of page 1, one of the things that we were putting in there, it said, with no habitable dwelling permanently affixed to the land. And the committee and the sponsor and the industry that the sponsors represented is all in agreement that that should be reduced. So the amendment takes away the words permanently affixed to the land. And I hope that answers your question. I would call for the question. Ask for an aye vote.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 81, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. House Bill, Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back on the bill. There is a handout on your desk about House Bill 81, vacant land. A couple of sessions ago, we passed a bill, and it was related to when they were doing all those, taking a section and dividing it up into 40-acre lots and selling them. And as part of that discussion, we basically put into statute that we require sellers of vacant land to disclose a list of items, including the availability of public utilities, the availability of water and sewer infrastructure, the availability of fire protection services. But what we failed to address is the definition of vacant land. And those folks that deal in this business were very concerned that there was not a definition because it all encompassed so many people, people in like a city lot. Then did it require people that owned a vacant city lot? to file this disclosure statement. So they just asked for some sort of definition, and so we have now come up with a definition that for the purposes of this section, vacant land means with no habitable dwelling and not within the boundaries of a platted subdivision or city or town. And with that, I would stand for any questions and ask for your affirmative vote.
Chairman Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm wondering why you deleted what I see the platted subdivision, but the city or the town, I happen to know vacant land in several towns where it would be very useful information to know. They don't necessarily have utilities or any of that information readily available, and I guess I'm just wondering why that was taken out as the description of vacant land.
Representative Davis won it, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, if you have vacant land inside of a town or a city, it's usually pretty easy if you're doing due diligence to determine how much the sewer is going to cost and how much the electrical facilities are going to cost. What the problem is when they divided this land 20 miles out of town, people are on the Internet buying this land. They were selling all of their homely possessions and moving out to our wonderful state, only to find that they were going to be faced with $60,000-$70,000 just to get power out to their land. And that is why we pulled off. And if you're also asking about permanently affixed, there was a lot of discussion in the committee, you know, if that would include a shed that could possibly be lived in, if it included modular homes. And so that's why we felt it was in everybody's best interest just to say that it was not habitable.
Representative Madden.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I assume that applies, like if there's a industrial building or a commercial building on the unplatted land, and you could say that it's vacant even though the building is there because it's not habitable. I guess that's kind of an aberration away from what we think vacant land is.
To a certain extent, oh, Mr. Chairman, excuse me.
Representatives want it, sir.
Yes, to a certain extent. When it comes into commercial, there is also a part on the property disclosure statement that says a buyer may waive disclosure of information. So if you're looking at some sort of an industrial building, well, it would not be on vacant land. So that would be a commercial sense. So, yes, I understand what you're saying, that I may need help on that one. Commercial buildings would come under a different section, but I think you'd be able to do the due diligence on that work to make that pass. This property disclosure statement, I think, was mostly aimed for homeowners or land where homeowners are going to build their homes. Otherwise, I would have to look into that just a little further.
Representative Croker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want this to go the same direction that I think it went in our committee meeting, and I think we got on tangent and made it a whole lot more complicated than it needed to be. Basically, there's an existing law in place that just says if you're purchasing vacant land, a disclosure statement is required. This just defines what that vacant land is. So if there's any doubts, all that's going to happen is there's going to be a disclosure statement, and all the stuff that's on there is going to be disclosed anyway. It's not changing definitions. It's not changing zoning. It's not changing anything else. So any of that confusion, if it adds to it, there's going to be a disclosure statement, and all that stuff is going to be cleared up in the disclosure statement anyway. So it doesn't need to get more complicated than it is.
Representative Greer.
Mr. Chairman, I do wish to make it a little bit more complicated. I understand the purpose for the underlying statute, and I do understand and appreciate this bill. However, it appears that it's targeted at ranchette type of subdivision issues of 40 acres. And as I interpret this, this would also apply to a family that wants to sell the North Ranch that is just ranch land or vacant ranch land. And I think the bill would be, or this definition of vacant land would be much better if we had a 40-acre provision or something along those lines included to focus this down to what we're looking at. I understand the reason for the underlying bill, and I do appreciate this bill. However, it does have a much broader scope than I think is intended, and maybe we should look at getting that focused and including that definition, 40-acre parcels or tracts or something to that effect. It's just more of a comment on the bill. Thank you.
Representative Davis Wanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me remind the body that this is here for the unsophisticated buyer. So when you get into ranch land and commercial land, you have very sophisticated buyers. They're able to do due diligence. They know what they're after, what they're looking for. What we're trying to cover what these folks are the unsophisticated buyer, first-time home, or I should say first-time possible real estate buyers that do not understand the system, and we think that this bill will cover what we need to do. We did have a lot of discussion in committee about agricultural land, but as you can imagine, if somebody's going to make a major investment of that nature, they're going to have their ducks in a row, I believe. Or they have the option of saying, I don't need the property disclosure statement because I understand it would be just unrealistic to determine how much it would be to run power to all portions of the agricultural land involved. But with that being said, we'd be more than happy to look at a definition. The purpose of this bill is to get some sort of definition into the books.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just am trying to get my mind wrapped around why this is necessary. And I do understand the need to disclose, I guess, what the definition of vacant land is, but I don't think it's the state's responsibility to make sure that every buyer understands what they're buying when they buy it. That's their responsibility. So I don't know how far down the road of trying to define this stuff we'd like to go, but and maybe there's a better reason than what I just stated, but I'd like to have some good understanding for why we need this.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill, I think, is very well intentioned. However, the last speaker raised a pretty poignant point. Trying to say two things at the same time with start with P with me is a disaster. But I'd like to see the bill move forward, and some suggestions have been made about maybe there's some things need to be done to the bill. But looking at the sheet that was handed out and some of the things that with it, I'm a little confused also. So I'd hate to kill something that's important because it's not clear in my mind where just exactly where we're going. So I'd like to see the bill move forward. I guess that's what I'm up here pleading with you for.
Chairman Brown.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the point is this, that this statute already exists, and it already says every seller, with the one exception, if there's a waiver, we already have in law, it says every seller of vacant land shall provide a prospective buyer with a property disclosure statement. And when we fought that battle, either a year or 2 years ago, whenever it was, I think we agreed that it's as much for the benefit of sellers as buyers, because it does force into the real estate transaction information that the buyer ought to know and that buyers frequently are not obtaining. And I think that we said this is stuff that buyers ought to know so that they're not coming back later and saying that they weren't fully informed and they didn't get what they bargained for. And so that's what the first one we said was, they have to be told whether it's a unified estate or not. And the second is, if the ownership of the underlying mineral estate has in any way been severed in the chain of title from the surface estate. And I think those were sellers who were insisting that contracts begin to include that information so that buyers would understand what they're getting into, especially with the effect to split estate property. So I think that's why we did it, and it says every seller of vacant land. So I think the real question on this bill is, do you want to further refine what every seller of vacant land means. If we don't pass this bill, then it's probably more wide open than if we do pass this bill.
Chairman Korberg.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Based on the comments of the last speaker, I guess I'm not seeing what is the harm of having it more open so that, I mean, it seems to me like this definition is really limiting that, in other words, it's excluding a lot of sellers who would otherwise have to disclose. So I guess I'm wondering what the downside is of leaving the statute just the way it is right now, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Representative Botten.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In practicing law, I've run into an occasion where, well, it's not just an occasion. It seems like oftentimes real estate contracts contain a provision in there that you can't really rely on anything, including the property condition statements, anyway. So the way these standard realty contracts seem to be written, it adds in the waiver by the buyer anyway. Just want to point that out.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just responding to the question about what's wrong with the law if we don't pass this, one of the big problems is, if you look at Division 2I, excluding them from excluding properties that are already in a subdivision, city, or town is very important because has been confusion. Remember, when we passed both the large acre subdivision bills, we have small subdivisions, large subdivisions. All of those have their own disclosure requirements. And if you have a chunk of land in one of those, you have a set of disclosure requirements that you have to fall under. What's been the confusion around the state has been, if you have a chunk of vacant land in those, do you have to comply with those disclosures as well as a duplicative and possibly inconsistent disclosure requirement, or which one governs? This just makes clear, look, we've got, within all those contexts, we do have disclosure requirements. You comply with those if you're in a subdivision, if you're in a city or a town. But if you're outside, that's when this disclosure requirement comes in. So it clarifies the obligations of the landowner.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When the good representative from House District 14 mentioned you have to let people know whether you've severed mineral rights to the property, vacant property. But we've learned in the last year that some people have made agreements to sever their wind rights. So the question, I guess, is should that be added to the notification, and should that also go into statute like we've done with mineral rights? Now, I know there's a bill being proposed that you can't do that going forward, but I think we had some experience with that in the middle of our state in the last couple of years.
Chairman Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I'd submit that is a good suggestion. It would have to be a separate bill. I don't think it'd go on this one. But certainly, if we're gonna say that it's a good thing to make sure that buyers are informed that there's a split estate, what's good for the goose ought to be good for the gander. If the split estate is minerals, we say they ought to know, then certainly it would cut the same way. And if the wind estate's been severed, they should be informed. That would be the subject matter for a separate bill, and maybe I'll just cruise into LSO and have it drafted, because that we should do that.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Ilway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Bill number 81 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
House Bill 81 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 133. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 133, introduced by Representative Childers, an act relating to game and fish regarding special limited fishing permits. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which recommended it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Botten, Connolly, Davison, Yeagy, McKim, McComey, Petroff, Shepperson. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report, that it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 133 do pass, and I further move adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment to the bill. And I will explain the Standing Committee Amendment and then turn the bill over to its sponsor, the good representative from the Buffalo Man's Country. And what this bill is, it's about special limited fishing permits, and he'll explain the bill, but it's dealing with high school courses, and the bill had a limitation of under 18 years of age in it. There are children that are in school that are over 18 years of age, and there are those that are on IEP plans, and they can be as old as 21 years of age and still be in high school. So the committee felt we should delete on page 2, line 5, under the age of 18 years. And sometimes some of these activities take place later after school is out, but normally school is out. And we felt we needed to strike hours in order to comply with that part of the school, what schools do. And with that, I'd stand for questions on the Standing Committee Amendment. I'll call the question.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 133, please say aye. Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Chairman Childers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's set up. Set up, wake up, and pay close attention. I would like to welcome Deb White from Cody and her students from Cody High and the Youth for Justice program. If y'all all stand up there. Thank you. Now sit down. House Bill 133, Special Limited Fishing Permits. And those folks that just stood up, that's the reason you're supposed to be paying attention. And we are making a small amendment to 23-2-207 to add students to the education program. Going to page 2 of the bill. It just basically says any Wyoming accredited school to any enrolled student who is participating in a curriculum-based program as described in statutes 21-9-101, which entitles a student to fish during normal school days while under the direct supervision of the school. And 21-9-101 is basically just the courses of study under the school program. And that's what the bill is. It's just to allow students to do a little fishing, but under the direct supervision. And if you look around in your end basket or possibly on your desk, this is a handout that the students should have given you to explain it a little bit more. Strong support by our local game warden and the PE teachers. And we have schools included Cody, Worland, Pinedale, Mount View, Green River, and as I just found out the Natrona school has it, as well as others. He practically ripped the bill out of my hand, so I think he was real pleased about it. So, but anyway, that's a simple program, and I really thank the kids for bringing it. And Mrs. Flack cracks a mean whip, so they did a good job. And I'm sure that nobody is going to vote no on this. So, are there any questions?
Representative Crone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any questions for the good chairman from from the place where the Buffalo Man founded. But what I did want to say is I want to welcome everybody from my alma mater, the greatest high school in Wyoming. And so glad you could all be here. This is an excellent bill, and I really urge everyone to support it. And welcome down here, folks from the greatest high school in Wyoming history. Thank you.
Representative Croker. Chairman
Mr.
Childers.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that the good representative realized I've already thanked him for showing up, but that's all right. All of my children graduated from Cody also. My daughter, number one in tennis and doubles, her junior year. So anyway, should I talk about my student or my children or back on the bill?
Back on the bill, enough of the Bronx, but we're all for them. Representative Croker.
I think this is a great bill. I would suggest one slight change to it, and that would be to take out normal school days. I think that it would be wholly appropriate for a school class to arrange for a Saturday fishing trip or something like that. That's in addition to not being during normal hours, might also not be during normal days. So I think it would make the bill stronger if the bringer of the bill would be in support of that change.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This just might be the best bill brought to this session. It's a little glimmer of light out in the middle of all these education bills. And I appreciate the Cody Youth for Justice group bringing it. This is a real issue, and the guys at my school have been after me, and I frankly keep forgetting, but we have a class, physical education class, where they archery, they shoot, and they go fishing. The kids all have to buy a fishing license. And most of them, I mean, the whole idea of Game and Fish are states to get youth involved, because the trend is not good. And so I know this deal will sail right through, but I just want to say it's a great bill and appreciate you bringing it. Thank you.
Representative Pedersen.
Mr. Chairman, I rise in support of this bill. As I was fishing through my desk here, I certainly don't want to cast doubt on this, but as we take on many bills this session, and we're going to tackle many of them, I just want to note this bill's really got me hooked.
Chairman Lockhart, can you follow that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is a difficult one to follow, but I'll give it a shot. Years ago, I was on the committee that dealt with fishing and hunting in the state of Wyoming. And there was a lack of young people getting engaged in that, and I think that that's been part of our heritage. And if we can get young people to see the fun and the fascination and thrill of fishing, I think that's a good thing. And I thought to myself about one of the things that's in here. I would have probably died to get a chance to get away from algebra and geometry and advanced English and probably some of the other courses to spend a little time fishing with a Game and Fish representative so that I could learn how to love something that I already love better.
Chairman McCobie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And bringing this to a close, I hope. It was a great debate. The good bill sponsor introduced the bill and then turned the explanation of the bill over to the students, who did a wonderful job. They were able to answer all the questions of the committee. And it's just great to see this type of activity within our schools. The civics part of it, to come down here and, and lobbyists and see these things. So I'd urge your support of the bill, and I again would like to tell their sponsor and their teachers and the kids what a great job they did and how well they've behaved. Thank you.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Bill number 133 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill number 133, and thank you to the Code of Youth for Justice, has passed the Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Would you move House Bill 127 to the bottom of your list?
Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 88. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 88, introduced by Representative McComey, an act relating to guides and outfitters in the Wyoming Board of Outfitters. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Barbudo, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Peasley, Throne, signed Representative Brown, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 88 do pass. And I further move Standing Committee Amendment number 1 and would turn both the explanation of the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment over to the sponsor.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill is was brought at the request of the outfitters and their organizations and their board of directors. And first I'd like to talk a little bit about the Standing Committee Amendment to the bill.
Please do.
There were some concerns with the bill that were expressed by the hunting and fishing groups, and on page 2, lines 17 through 20, language was taken out of the bill, which satisfied one of their concerns. Then there was another concern with the bill that private landowners that would bring people into their land and allow them to hunt, that those private landowners all did not have to get outfitters permits and licenses and things like this because it was private land. And that was language in the bill was changed on with line 5, and also line 5 was the main thing because there was already a part of the bill that was in there, and this referred back to that and clarified that situation. Also on page 3, line 6, we inserted for the purposes of financial gain in order and struck or remuneration. And I didn't say that right, but that's what for pay otherwise. And that was a better explanation, it was felt, of that. And we deleted a few words for clearing up the language. Is there? And I'd stand for any questions on the Standing Committee Amendment.
You've heard an explanation of the Standing Committee Amendment. Is there a motion? Question been called for. All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 88, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, basically what this bill does, it protects. It was designed to not restrict the private property owners' rights, and it does give two things for the board. Number one, it gives the board the more authority to investigate unlicensed outfitting, and it allows the board to deny or issue a license if people haven't been in compliance or people have violated those things. And there's one other particular thing that's happening I'd like to explain in the bill. It allows the board to compel somebody to appear before the board when they've made a claim or an accusation against an outfitter or another outfitter against them, which hasn't been happening. People will make these claims and then not show up, which means they really weren't serious about the claim, but they were just trying to cause somebody some heartburn. And that's basically what is in this bill.
Is there further discussion on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Brown's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 88 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill number 88 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 34. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 34, introduced by Representative McComey, an act relating to taxation and revenue regarding tax distributions. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Blickery, Camel, Childers, Miller, Semlick, Vranish, No, Madden, Peterson, Excused, Goggles, signed, Representative Childers, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Childers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 34 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And I will turn the podium over to the good representative or chairman from the land near the reservations to explain the bill and the amendment.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill redistributes the sales tax distributions. This bill gives 5% more sales tax to cities and counties and gives 5% less sales tax, goes to the general fund. And I'd like to talk about the Standing Committee Amendment first. And what the Standing Committee Amendment does is, because we're already only 6 months into a fiscal biennium, it says that basically any sales tax revenue that cities and counties get from this bill, from this change in revenue flow from the sales tax, the one-time money that they're getting in this present budget goes back to the general fund to offset these costs, because they've already been funded in this biennium, and the governor and other people are working on sources, additional sources. So this is really a revenue neutral bill. There are two or three counties that would receive a little bit extra money from this, and those are, of course, are the counties that have all the mineral development in it at the present time. The county where there's a hump in the animal that they represent, and the over the mountain from the land of the waters where I come from, the Sinking River, just right over the mountain. And those beautiful mountains over there are the two main areas that would receive extra funds, real funds through that in addition. And that is it. The rest of the bill remains revenue neutral. And what it's saying is, cities and counties, here is 5% more discretionary funding. And if you look at the fiscal note, and I don't know if all of you have the updated fiscal note, but the fiscal note for the bill, it's about $32 million per year for more money that would go to cities and counties. And, of course, as I have already explained, there would be $32 million less one-time money that's already been budgeted for the next biennium not go to them. So it would be a revenue neutral bill. But from that, but that money that they receive now, they have the discretion on how it can be spent, and they will be able to use that to match some of these one-time monies that that require matches from the Farm Loan Board, the Business Council, all of those funds that they work. So it gives them more money that they've got discretion with that they can use. And with that, I'll stop and let you can ask me questions.
We're on the Standing Committee Amendment. Is there further discussion on the Standing Committee Amendment? Are you ready for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment? Question having been called, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Further discussion. Representative Pedersen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brothers and sisters of the 61st, I would call upon you to ask you to maybe look at this bill with a little bit of caution. We're working, and it'll be out with you from down the hallway, to put together a really good funding for the cities, towns, and counties. It's actually more substantial than what this bill is written. The other piece is that this is an ongoing budget item that's in here, that you're changing an ongoing permanent funding mechanism during a supplemental budget. What's interesting is one of the things that will be before you is a footnote to the governor that will direct him to adjust exactly what we're talking about in his budget to make sure that the cities, towns, and counties will receive for the next biennium no less than they've received this time, and to adjust the budget accordingly and the percentages of the above the cap. And when you look at this type of change, I don't think that we should do it in this format. We've come together with a nice package for cities, towns, counties that will be on your desk this week. And we have also provided a footnote for ongoing funding in the future. And I'd urge you to look at that mechanism for the ongoing support of our cities, towns, counties, and perhaps resist this. Thank you.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would echo same kind of caution that the good representative from District 7 just reported here. You know, the revenue neutrality is appropriate to talk about for this biennium, but it's not appropriate to talk about in the long run as we go into the future, because once this number is set, it's for all practical purposes, it's either going to be there forever or it's going to get higher. And during committee, we had, as you would expect, lots of local government people there. And as they went down the line, the big issue for them was the fluctuations that they're experiencing in revenue. And the fluctuations are problematic, of course, for small or local governments, but this bill does not help in fluctuations, because state revenue fluctuates vis-a-vis the sales tax as well. So these numbers can go up and down. I guess I would argue that if you raise their dependence on the sales tax, the fluctuations will be more painful than they were in the past. The thing that, you know, also concerns me, you know, while it's always nice to give and give and give to local governments, you know, we've got to think of what kind of scary things that can befall the state finances in the future. You know, I still worry about what happens if this healthcare thing isn't straightened out and we have exploding Medicaid payments and things like this. You know, I agree, we probably got the money, we can do it this way, but we've always been pretty cautious this way, and we look at it every year to see what we have available. And you know, it's really, you turn it over on the fiscal note, and we're appropriating here today taking the first step to appropriate $32 million out of our general fund, and it's going to go up and up and up as the economy grows from now until kingdom comes. So I'd urge you to take a strong look at this before you agree to it. Thank you.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the 61st, again, I'd urge caution. These bills come every now and then, every year or two, and we generally do the right thing and defeat them. And it was talked that it was revenue neutral, except for the $32 million hit to the general fund year after year. And I would just show you that, you know, if you look at your goldenrod, and if we're going to honor savings into the LSRA, you know, we have about $97 million in general fund available for us to spend. And if we don't want to tip into the LSRA, we're sitting there at about $174 million. So as of today, there were $350 million profiled in bills that have been read in and passed first reading. So something's got to give. So here's some of that 350 is this 32 million, undoubtedly. But I guess I would just say to you that we have given the cities and towns not only a 5-cent optional tax for operations, we also a few years ago gave them a 6-cent. And there's, to my knowledge, no one's using the 6-cent. Not many are using the 5-cent. And again, now it comes to come back to the state share of this. I'd be careful, and let us come down each year. What we are elected to do is to look at all of the state's needs, all of the state's interests, and actually appropriate. That's what we do. We have the power of the purse, and to simply kind of start handing these things over by de-earmarking, changing percentages, those kind of things, we're going to end up where we were 10 years ago, where we're hoping somebody in Florida, when they pass away, we get their inheritance and can tax it. You know, I mean, it's just, we don't want to be in that situation. And so don't chip away at this revenue stream. These are, you know, pretty closely balanced. So I'd urge caution and a no vote on this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Ilovay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm on this bill. And quite frankly, this bill should have gone, before it came here, it should have gone to appropriations. They're the ones that should deal with this. They could have brought it back to you if they'd chosen, or you would have seen it again in the budget. We should not vote on this one today or pass it. Unfortunately, since I am on it, I'm going to ask you to kill it because it needed to go, as I said, to appropriations first.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would encourage the body to vote no on this bill. You haven't received this handout. Some of you have during training in various parts, but we've been working on the budget, as you know. In fact, we spent until 9 o'clock Friday night marking up the budget, and we hope to finish it this evening. We've appropriated funds to local government for the supplemental, and we have given direction to the governor for the next biennium. For some of you that have not been here, we've also had interim studies on how to do distribution to our local government. We have one of our presentations that we've put together shows that the net impact since we had de-earmarking between the years of 2002 and 2012, our local government's impact above their cap funding is $524 million. We have, as a state, been very generous to our local government. So I think it's important to keep that into consideration. I respect the bringers of this bill for looking at innovative ways of helping local government. But I do think that we are doing a good job at this time and would appreciate a no vote.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the 61st, I also ask you to view this bill with caution. As the chairman of our committee just mentioned, this body has been, and I'm absolutely positive, will continue to be as generous as we can be with our local governments, because I think all of us really understand that the government closest to the people is that which is most effective. Nonetheless, the state doesn't always have, we go through good times and we go through bad times. We are a boom and bust state. That is a fact of our life. And if we dedicate these kind of locked-in earmarks, which is essentially what this bill is asking us to do, that chips away at the discretionary power that we as a legislature have to look at the whole picture and to deal with the situation from year to year. When we have plenty of money, I can guarantee you, as history has proven, that we will share that with the local governments. When the belts need to be tightened, we also need to have the ability to do that. That's our job. That's our fiduciary responsibility to the citizens of Wyoming.
Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all the comments that have been given, and I hope we're taking those into consideration. I also would like to just say this is not a budget session, and if we're I just caution us all, if a bill has an appropriation and it's not an emergency, we just about ought to be voting no. That's just about what we ought to be doing right now. So, thank you.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'm one of about a dozen that were here when we de-earmarked funding to cities, towns, counties, and others. And we did that because we were out of money and we needed to tighten down. And at that time, we said that when we have money, we will recirculate it back. And in fact, that's been our history. But because of the wise and, I think, frugal kind of an approach that we did in a time when we were under a lot of pressure because we were $180 million short of meeting budget, we made that hard decision, and it gave us the flexibility that we could use the revenues when they came up to help the people that were taken off the earmarks, but to do some other things like funding additional money for scholarships and for schools and for other things that we as this body deemed were also a priority. If you have it all earmarked and going one direction, you can't pull it back for a better or a higher need.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a complicated issue. Our revenue picture is complex. I think it's premature to consider killing this bill today. With all due respect to the good members of our committee number two, their speech, even though I haven't been here that many years, sounds surprisingly familiar. It's kind of the same speech every year, with all due respect. So I would suggest to the body that to preserve our options, because none of us except the seven members of committee number two have any idea what's actually happening with the budget at this time, that we keep this bill alive to have it available for our consideration in the event that we disagree, imagine that, with what committee number two proposes. Our local governments need a more flexible source of funding. This is one of the options out there. Sales tax revenue is never predictable and reliable for anyone, and the local governments can experience that the way we do at the state level. So let's keep the bill on the table to have it as an option going forward as we consider the budget bill.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In light of the confusion with the sponsors suggesting that we kill it by virtue of not having it referred to committee number two, the appropriations, if it's appropriate, I would move that we re-refer the bill and would so move.
Chairman McComey.
Well, thank you very much. Good comments, all of them.
I think we have a point of order, Mr. Chairman. There's a motion on the floor, and we're going to have to deal with that first.
Thank you. Let's put the House in brief recess while we ask Mr. Majority Floor Leader and others to confer on that motion. Would members of the Rules Committee please come to the front of the chamber?
Mr. Chairman.
Just a moment, please. Chairman Illelei.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I second Representative Patton's motion.
Representative Patton.
Chairman, I will agree to withdraw the motion to re-refer as the main motion is available, and that too will be withdrawn. We will meet the same end. So I move to withdraw the motion to re-refer.
Chairman Illelei, the motion by Representative Patton is withdrawn. Will you withdraw your second?
Yes.
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Chairman, for House Bill 34,
I would like to withdraw my motion for a due pass.
The motion has been withdrawn. We will leave House Bill 34 with it having been with the motion for due pass having been withdrawn. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 136. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 136, introduced by Representative Barbuto, an act relating to vacancies in office, appointments to county commissioner vacancy. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illaway, Yagi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Shepperson, Stubson. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with recommendation that House Bill 136 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment and the representative from House District 48 will explain the bill and the amendment.
Representative Barbuto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A former legislator told me that if you stand at this podium, you connect with your audience best out of all the other podiums. So if any of you are feeling particularly connected, that's the only reason. Don't be alarmed. I'm happy to bring before you House Bill 136. And oh, yeah, I felt it. But I'm gonna go ahead and explain the bill and then the amendment, because the amendment is pretty simple. What we're looking at is right now when you have an independent or an unaffiliated commissioner, if they're to resign before their term is up, the law says, the election code says that you're supposed to publish that in a paper for X amount of days, during which time they'll take applications for the position, and they'll have so many days to make the remaining commissioners have so many days to make the appointment. But then it says, except as provided over here in the county statutes. When you go over to the county statute, which is the 183524A Romanet 2, and it's basically said, just go ahead and appoint someone. You don't have to do the public notice. You don't have to take applications. Just appoint someone. And this happened in our home county down in the southwestern corner of the state. And that was kind of the motivation for bringing this bill. So what we've done, if you go on to page 2, if you're looking at the bill, we just strike that language on lines 16 and 17 that says, may appoint any qualified person to fill the vacancy, and replace it with the same language that's in the election code, that they'll have to publish it in a newspaper of general circulation. Here it says 15 days. We'll get to the amendment here in a moment. After publication, any qualified person can apply for that position, and then the remaining commissioners will have 20 days to make the appointment. So what the amendment does is take that 15-day period that you see on line 19 and turns it into 20, and that's in line with what it would be for a person who is a member of a political party. If they were to resign, the political party would have, the county party would have the 20 days. So that just makes that line up nicely there. And then just because there's, now you have two 20-day periods, the second amendment on line 22, it hopefully avoids confusion so that you know that after that 20-day period, the commissioner still have 20 days to make the appointment. So with that, I guess recommend that we vote on that standing committee amendment, and I'd stand for any questions.
We're voting on Standing Committee Amendment 1 to House Bill 36. Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Question having been called, All those in favor of Representative Ilway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 136 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 136 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 143. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 143, introduced by Representative Miller, an act relating to taxation and revenue, manufacturing tax exemption. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Camel, Childers, Miller, Peterson, Vranish, no, Madden, Semlich, excused, Goggles. Signed, Representative Childers, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Childers?
Mr. Chairman, I was distracted for a minute. You know how some of these attorneys are. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 143 do pass. And with that, I'll turn the bill over to the good representative from... Let me find him first. District 55, to explain the bill.
And there are no amendments, no standing committee amendments. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is the manufacturing tax exemption. It's a bill that changes the sunset date, adds another number of years to it, I believe 5 years. You might ask what is a manufacturing tax exemption. This goes to those industries that take materials in Wyoming, turn it into another product, and then sell it. The Trona industry is one of those that uses this a great deal. That's one of the leading exporting industries in Wyoming. Looking at the tax benefits in Wyoming, I think this is one of the better uses of the tax exemptions that were so free and giving here on in this Capitol building. This particular industry actually takes a raw material, which we tax heavily. We have severance and ad valorem taxes. They add value to it, and then they sell it into the marketplace. If we took the tax exemption away, there's a chance it could affect their bottom line, and they're not able to take that raw material and add value to it to be able to export it out of this country. But that's just one example of many. The Wyoming, our business council is very supportive of this. They use this in their basket of goods to try to attract businesses to Wyoming. I believe the majority of the states in the country offer manufacturing tax exemptions from testimony and committee. They feel they also need this tax exemption. What the bill does is on page 2, line 5, it changes the sunset date from the end of this year, December 31st, 2011, to 2016. On page 2, lines 15 to 19, it also adds a reporting requirement. So, again, it's pretty straightforward. The manufacturing exemptions that are covered here even include quilters that buy materials and machines to do that type. So it covers a huge gamut of products that help our Wyoming citizens create goods for sale. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly rise in support of this extension. It's 5 years that we're looking at here, and Wyoming is coming off an economic pause. We have a recovery that's underway, and I think by passing this particular piece of legislation for 5 more years, it will certainly bring additional benefits to Wyoming. I have stood on this floor before when we initially did this bill, and there were a lot of questions on just what kind of an impact this would have. In the time that it has been in place, I believe the multiplier effect has been well displayed, that we have gained numerous benefits from having this, not only from a competitive market, from various other states and localities, the industries that are looking at this. But prior to this session, I had a meeting with individuals, of course, from Southwest Wyoming on the soda ash industry, as well as petroleum refinery individuals. They expressed expansion and certainly would ask for continuance and support of this because it creates jobs, it creates an environment that is conducive to additional business for the state of Wyoming. So I would exhort the body to move forward with a five-year extension on this particular piece of legislation.
McCombe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I will support this legislation, and I'm going to tell you why, as a famous guy used to be down here used to say. I do believe that we're experiencing a boom again, starting to come back a little bit. And if this will help us expand the Trona industry and do some of the other things, I guess it's all right. But in my times here, I have railed against exemptions. You heard me talk the other day, an exemption bill. And I got up and I said, I was supported it, but here's why I was concerned about it. Here's a five-year exemption that's just been extended another 5 years. And nobody has proven to me that all these good things that happened and all this money that these businesses and that have come here have brought to us in tax revenues would have done that anyway. Because this is where the minerals are. This is where the wind blows. This is where the Trona is. But I do think we need to give them all the help we can. And I very much respect the bringer of the bill because he's usually right there with me bemoaning the fact that we do these kinds of things.
Representative Roscoe.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a question for the good bringer of the bill. I think it was just answered. But how long has this exemption been in place?
Excuse me, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I believe it was probably close to 10 years that it's been there. And it may have been here before that also. I think it's been there a long time, as a lot of these exemptions are. You know, maybe we want to somehow amend it and just take the sunset off. And then if some future legislature wants to come back in and put it back on, that's their obligation possibly in the future. But it's been there quite a while. I don't know, those of you who have been in this House for a number of years know what tough times the some of the industry mineral patches have had over the last 10 years especially. There's one certain large Asian country that's leader was just in Washington, D.C., that manufactures some of these products just from scratch without mining any raw material. That's who we're competing against with this product from Southeast Wyoming that was made by Mother Nature. You actually have to mine that particular product, and you have to process it to turn it into a sellable project. I'm not convinced this industry would have survived the last 10 years if we hadn't had some of these small tax breaks. I think I think the feds even gave them a royalty tax rebate during these very tough years to where they were on the verge of not surviving here in Wyoming. So again, it's we've had it quite a while. The representative from over the hill, and we're asking to keep it on. But again, of all the exemptions we do, and I vote for a lot of other ones that don't have anything to do with producing wealth out of the ground that we tax the heck out of, but this one we tax, and we get a return on investment. Every one of these jobs in this particular area of Wyoming pays roughly $120,000 in wages and benefits per employee. They pay almost $30,000 per employee in various taxes. Boy, I challenge you to come up with any other industry in Wyoming that pays wages and pays taxes like that. I sure don't think that that data center that may come over the hill here will pay anywhere near that on a per-job basis.
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that exemption, this is the 2011, is the second exemption. It was put in place in about 2001.
Thank you. Representative Blake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I definitely rise in support of this bill. The soda ash industry is experiencing a little boom right now. Now's not the time to get rid of this. They just reopened a second mine that a company owns down in southwest Wyoming. It had been mothballed for several years. And it's not only soda ash jobs, it's for the people who haul soda ash. And I just urge your support on this. Thank you.
Question. Question having been called. All those in favor of Representative Childers that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 143 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill number 143 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye. Opposed, no. The motion carries.
Clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 95, recommended do pass. House Bill 96, amended, recommended do pass. Representative Loveno moved that the Committee of the Whole rise and sit again, and the motion prevailed. House Bill 73, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 75, recommended do pass. House Bill 29, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 81, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 133, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 88, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 34, the motion that the bill do pass Committee of the Whole was withdrawn by the chairman for the purpose to re-refer the appropriation to committee number 2. House Bill 136, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 143, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Bonner, Chairman.
I move the adoption of the Committee of Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report is adopted. We're at that order of business, messages from the Senate.
Message number 130. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 10, Protection of Livestock Animals. Ayes 29, noes 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 131. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 14, Counties, Election Districts. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 132. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 51, Safety Belt Violations. Ayes 19, noes 11, Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 133. Mr. Speaker, the bill listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 55, Subdivision Perimeter Petition Partition Fencing. Ayes 26, noes 4. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 134. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below passed the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 58, Landowner Rights in Wind Energy Development. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 135. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 3, Campaign Finance Organizations. Ayes 28, noes 2. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 136. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 47, Concealed Weapons. Ayes 20, noes 10. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
We're at that order of business. Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 137, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illaway, Yagi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Shepperson, Stubson. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Joint Resolution number 5, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illaway, Patton, Roscoe. No, Yagi, Croker, Shepperson, Stubson. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
We're at that order of business, re-referrals. Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move to re-refer House Bill 127 to Committee Number 2, Appropriations.
It's been moved House Bill 127 be re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Chairman Childers.
Mr. Speaker, I would like to re-refer House Bill 34 to Appropriations. It has some money changes in it.
We move for House Bill 34 to be re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Committee announcements. Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet Tuesday, tomorrow, January 25th, at noon recess in House 18.
Or Tuesday.
We're going to discuss House Bill 186, Wyoming Lottery, and House Bill 53, Wyoming Lottery for Education.
Chairman Brown.
Mr. Speaker, Judiciary Committee Number 1 will meet tomorrow morning, Tuesday, January 25th at 7:30 a.m. to consider the following bills. House Bill 142, Discrimination. House Bill 157, Abolition of Worthier Title Doctrine. House Bill 158, Rule Against Perpetuities. And House Bill 159, Uniform Trust Code Amendments.
Sounds like a law school exam. Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet Wednesday morning at 8 a.m., room H18, to hear House Bill 114, Insurance Premiums Failure to Pay, House Bill 129, Nuclear Energy Production Study, and House Bill 48, Placement of Wind Energy Facilities. And if I may, Mr. Speaker, privilege of the floor.
Please proceed.
This is your first heads up for this week's legislative prayer breakfast. Incidentally, we had a great number of people at the first one. That'll be this Thursday, 6:30, at the Egg and I, and the speaker will be John Cox, who is the director of our Wyoming Highway Department.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 6, travel will meet Wednesday at 8 a.m., where we will take up a bill that we had to lay back, House Joint Resolution 6, Private Property Protection.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 4, Education, will meet immediately upon adjournment today in H-10 for consideration of the following bills: House Bill 52, Charter School Restrictions; House Bill 115, Charter School Applications; and House Bill 85, Teacher Suspension.
Chairman Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8, Transportation, will meet tomorrow, Tuesday, January 25th, 10 minutes after adjournment in room H-17. We will consider House Bill 154, Multiple Special Handicapped License Plates, and House Bill 77, Disabled Veterans License Plate Handicapped Parking.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee, too, will meet tomorrow at 1 p.m. to hear House Bill 61, the Omnibus Water Bill Planning. And for the committee members, there's a large legislative report that should be at your desk. Please make sure to have that with you. And then today we will meet upon adjournment 5 minutes for a quick meeting and then return to JAC for marking up the budget.
Chairman Simulek.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, will meet Tuesday, January 25th at 7 a.m. in room 302 to continue hearing House Bill 12, Irrigation Districts Change of Place of Use; House Bill 16, Wyoming Beef Council Feed Collection; House Bill 64, Property Disclosure Statements; House Bill 6, Packaging, Labeling, and Advertising of Honey Repeal; House Bill 7, Wyoming Veterinary Medical Practice Act; and House Bill 130, Pregnancy Testing of Livestock. We will meet at 7 a.m., room 302. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet 15 minutes from now in room H-17 to hear the following bills: House Bill 65, Marital Counseling; House Bill 39, Health Litigation Fund; House Bill 106, Departments of Employment and Workforce Services Merger.
Representative Pedersen.
Mr. Speaker, quick privilege of the floor.
Please proceed.
Members of the 61st, we've always made this announcement every year, but during session, you all are members of the Cheyenne Country Club, and if you just let them know that you're a legislator, you have membership during session, and any of you who are exceptionally nice to me, I have Chairman Illaway's member number.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House adjourn until 10 a.m. tomorrow, January 25th, 2011, where on general file we will hear the following bills: House Bill 138, House Bill 137, House Bill 41, House Bill 46, House Joint Resolution 5, House Bill 82, House Bill 118, House Bill 10, House Bill 22, House Bill 66, House Bill 124, House Bill 35, and such other bills as may be referred to the Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The House is adjourned until Tuesday, January 25th, 2011, 10 a.m.